This is The Gaggle with David Helfenbein.
This week we have on Andrew Beatty, who is AFP's White House correspondent. Andrew, welcome to The Gaggle.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Thank you for coming on. Andrew, I'd like to start out talking about the role of a White House correspondent and what you do on a typical daily basis. Andrew, what is it like to be a White House correspondent and go to press briefings? Can you describe a little bit of your role?
Well, I mean, the first thing to say is it's quite a privilege. You get to have, I know it's a cliche, but you do get to have a front row seat to history. There's also a good bit of drudgery, a lot of hurry up and wait. A typical day for me starts, I have two small kids, so it starts whenever they wake me up, basically. Reading into the newswire, reading all the newspapers, and then heading into the White House. Usually in the morning, this White House in particular is not, I think they're forgiving me for saying they're not particularly, the president at least isn't a particularly early riser, in the sense that they don't pump out press releases first thing in the morning or pump out statements first thing in the morning. So things usually get going around 10, 11 o'clock. And then around midday or so, we usually have the press briefing, which is our opportunity to do a couple of things, really. I mean, to put the White House on the record on specific issues that we want to, that we are covering at that, on that given day. But it's also a chance to kind of put things on their radar as well, and just get answers about issues that, perhaps sometimes, maybe we've covered kind of in off the record conversations or in background conversations.
I know that a lot of people in the U.S. know about the Associated Press and the Reuters. Can you give a little bit more background into AFP and what you cover as a wire service?
Yeah, I mean, AFP is actually the oldest newswire in the world. It was set up with roughly the same idea as Reuters and so on, a little less financial focused at the beginning. But we're basically an international newswire, and what that means is we have bureaus all over the world. I think it's 150 bureaus. We have clients all over the world as well, from everyone from GG, the Japanese news agency, to the Times in Delhi, to Fox News, to the New York Times. We have a photo, video, and text service, and the text service publishes in, I'm not quite sure how many languages, but in English, Spanish, French, German, Arabic, so what is that, five? And we basically, I mean, my job here is, as I say, we do have U.S. clients, but my job is primarily to cover the United States for the rest of the world. The vast majority of our clients are overseas. For the English service, that means predominantly in Asia, Africa, and Europe, but obviously we have to keep an eye on everything because everything we do gets translated into Arabic for Middle East clients and into Spanish for clients in Latin America and Spanish-speaking Europe.
How long is your posting in Washington, D.C. for?
We have four-year postings, basically. You can extend here or there, but it's a bit like the diplomatic service in that regard. So I've been here a year. I should be here 3 years more.
Before you were in D.C., where were you located and what were you reporting on?
So before I came to D.C., I was in Johannesburg. I was the news editor for Southern Africa, which basically involved organizing news coverage from 12 countries in sub-Saharan in Southern Africa. That for us was about five or six bureaus and about 30 or 40 stringers across text, video, and photo. I mean, it was an extremely busy period in Southern Africa. We had elections in South Africa, Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Namibia. But The biggest story that we covered was the death of Nelson Mandela.
What was it like to cover Mandela's death, and do you have any stories from covering that in particular?
It was an experience. The first thing that really struck me was you can't help but kind of get a little bit swept up in the emotion of what was going on then. This guy, to give a U.S. context, was, George Washington and, Mother Teresa rolled into one for South Africans. He was primus inter pares in terms of political figures in South Africa. He was, many South Africans consider that he almost single-handedly brought down apartheid. So it's not quite true, but he was instrumental. There was a great outpouring of grief is the wrong word, because South Africans, they grieve obviously like anybody else, but there was also, it was a celebration of his life as well. So it was over a period of 2 weeks, there was just phenomenal number of events and memorials and gatherings. I remember the night that he died, I kind of, I got the sense that something was going on. The government hadn't quite announced anything yet, but I lived quite close to his house. So I swung by and you could just see there was lots and lots of people outside with candles and so on. And I noticed that there was some of President Zuma's security detail there. So there was obviously something up, but the atmosphere was really, people knew this was coming for a long time. I mean, he was in hospital 3 or 4 times the year before he died. But it was, as a journalist, it was also extremely difficult to cover because the South African government, we'd had numerous meetings in private with them about what would happen if and when Mandela died. Whether it was a cultural thing or whether they were unprepared, they just really weren't willing to go into too much depth about how things would be covered. I mean, this was logistically a huge challenge. We had events over three places. His memorial service was in Johannesburg. The actual laying in state was in Pretoria, the capital. And then the actual burial was done in Kunu, which is in the rural Eastern Cape. And you need, we needed a small fleet of motorbikes to get our photographers around and a giant crane to get aerial shots and so on. So it was a really, logistically, it was a really, really difficult undertaking. Journalistically, in terms of writing, it was perhaps slightly easier just because the story kind of wrote itself. I mean, the emotion was there from South Africans. The angles were fairly obvious. His life was well documented. I found it pretty easy to write as a writer. To as a manager, it was a bit more difficult.
What was it like to cover Haiti after the earthquake?
That was quite an eye-opener. It was actually about 6 months before my wife and I had gone to Haiti on holiday. So, we'd gone to Port-au-Prince and Cap-Étienne, so we knew the place. We can both speak kind of enough French to get by, or the Creole's a bit tough. but really liked the place, and because we had a friend who worked for the UN and kind of told us some places to go, and we had a fantastic time. And then 6 months later, the quake hit, and it was pretty obvious from early on that it was huge. I think I was actually on the desk that day when they moved. We moved the alert about the quake, and I think the initial reading from the U.S. Geological Survey was something like 7.3, and it wasn't super deep. So we knew straight away that it was an absolutely enormous earthquake. And so then going back to, I flew to the Dominican Republic, and managed to make my way across the border into Port-au-Prince. And it was just, I don't know if you've seen old photos of Dresden during the Second World War. It was like that. There's a main street in Port-au-Prince by a market called the Marché aux Fers, the Iron Market. And it was just, everything was rubble, and there was a stench of dead bodies, and there was fire coming from gas pipes. And it was really, apocalyptic is probably the only way of describing it.
Have you ever covered war? And if so, what have you covered?
I covered the, I was in Libya for shortly after the revolution until basically the fall of Tripoli. That was a tremendous experience as well. It was a tough experience, but I actually, a couple of days after I arrived, my wife, I was on the sat phone and found out that my wife was pregnant. So that made me feel a little selfish, but it probably also made me a little safer in some of the things that I did. But it was, from the very beginning, it was just a tremendous experience to be there, to see Libyans kind of after casting off the yoke of, you know, 3 decades of this rule by this leader who was, you know, borderline sane, let's put it politely. There was an exuberance and people were extremely optimistic, but at the same time, Gaddafi's troops were not all that far away from Benghazi. We were sitting in Benghazi and, you know, making trips onto Ajdabiya, which at that point was the front. Just to give people an idea, Ajdabiya is it's a strategic crossroads in Libya. If you can take that town, then you can flank, you can go on a desert road and flank Benghazi, basically cut it off. So it was really, really important that the rebels held on to that. But it was a desert war in the sense of, like, it was large artillery field guns, firing it across from line to line. And, you know, the NATO forces were fixing some of the Gaddafi positions so they couldn't move their tanks so freely. But it was stalemate for a long time. And, you know, there were still Grad rockets going into Ajdabiya. After that, that kind of trundled on for quite some time, and I ended up going to Misrata, which had been under siege for, I don't know, like a month or at least a month by that point, probably a bit more. And the situation there was quite desperate. I mean, people were fighting on about 3 or 4 fronts out of the city. They were surrounded by Gaddafi soldiers, and Grad rockets were landing in the city every day. Half downtown was completely destroyed. It's not quite the same scale, but if you imagine the historic parallel to Stalingrad, then it kind of gives you an idea of what was going on. And these people were, I mean, the mood there was much less rejoiceful. It was like people had really, really been struggling and really suffering, and every man or boy had basically teamed up with their friends, got a pickup truck somehow, and mounted a gun on the back to make what they call a technical, just to go and fight against the Gaddafi forces. But they were really ill-equipped. They didn't know very much at the beginning about fighting. So there was a lot of, you know, people getting injured, and a whole brigade would go back with the injured soldier. And abandon a line so that some of their comrades further down would be exposed. But they eventually beat back Gaddafi. And in the end, it was actually the Amarvig, the Berbers in the, it was Berber brigades to the south of Tripoli that actually moved on Tripoli and took the Bab al-Azizia, Gaddafi's compound, and sacked the city, and he fled to Sirte. And then the war entered like a third half, if you will, a third period. Some of the guys from Benghazi went across. They tried to set up some kind of government. It was extremely chaotic. Things for Tripoli residents had not been good during the war either. They weren't bombed like Misrata, but things had been tough. I mean, there was a lot of people inside the city who hadn't supported Gaddafi and were always, you know, living in fear that they were going to get, you know, there would be a knock on the door at night, or that Gaddafi would find out, that some of his spies would find out that they had people, family members fighting in Benghazi or whatnot, and again, they just get a knock at the door. So there was a bit of celebration when the city was taken over by the rebels, but at the it was to be honest, it was fairly short lived as well. I mean, people knew that there was a huge task in front of them, and already you could see factions within the kind of rebel forces. The revolution had kind of fractured into multiple pieces by that point already, I would say. And a lot of the brigades, there was no collective command. You were basically in charge of yourself. So I think that's when this period of Libya's problems kind of began.
Did you feel unsafe when you were over there?
I felt unsafe when I was being shot at. yeah, I did. But, you know, we have an adage that if you're with the photographers, you're probably too close. But sometimes it wasn't really avoidable, just because it was sometimes extremely difficult to get to the front line. So the only way you could do that was to kind of jump in a pickup truck with a bunch of guys who don't really know what they're doing. And, you know, you'd be driving through guys using anti-aircraft weapons horizontally, and, you know, bullets going everywhere, and there were snipers and whatnot. So it was, yeah. I mean, you try and mitigate the risk by, you know, wearing a flak jacket and wearing a helmet and trying to pick who you go with wisely. But at the end of the day, sometimes you don't have too much choice.
Is there any respect for journalists over there in terms of not shooting at them, even though you got shot at? Or is it pretty much their...
Oh, no, this is... They were shooting at us because we were with rebel forces. It was Gaddafi guys shooting at us because we were with rebel forces. That said, I don't think... I mean, some of my colleagues were... Two of my colleagues and one of their colleagues were captured by Gaddafi forces, and they were put in prison for a while and later released. I don't think they had too much respect for journalists. The rebels certainly did, at least at the beginning. There was always a little tension with some of the brigades from eastern Libya. Some of the cities on the coast, Derna and Beta and a couple of other places, were pretty notorious throughout Gaddafi's period, or certainly at the end of Gaddafi's rule, for being kind of hotbeds for Al-Qaeda. Not Al-Qaeda in the, you know, kind of Osama bin Laden sense, but the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, which was a kind of offshoot. And, you know, there were a really large number, a disproportionate number of Libyans from that area who ended up being suicide bombers in Iraq, in part because, you know, there was just absolute desperation there. And so if the only venue for venting against Gaddafi was to join these groups. But the other reason was that Gaddafi actually let them leave because, you know, I think the thinking was, you know, better have them in Iraq than in Libya fighting against me.
The final question I always like to end with is a question of advice. What advice would you have if someone wants to enter the profession and follow a career path like yours?
Oof. well, I mean, I studied philosophy, so I'm not sure. And I accidentally became a journalist. I'm not quite sure I'm the best person to ask, but I mean, get the typical stuff, get work experience, you know, volunteer on your student newspaper and go and work as an intern somewhere. It's hard and it requires a good bit of luck, but as long as you're inquisitive, as long as you're naturally inquisitive, you'll do all right. I would also say that, you know, it helps quite early on to figure out what you're good at. I think a lot of people who get into journalism think of themselves as perhaps good writers, and, you know, there are a lot of writers who are good, there are a lot of journalists who are good writers, but there's a lot of them who are just really good reporters as well. And sometimes you can be really good at one and kind of adequate at the other, and as long as you play to your strengths, I think you'll be able to get on.
Andrew Beattie, AFP's White House correspondent, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for your time.